All right, g'day and welcome to the Riptide Bodyboarding Podcast, the home of bodyboarding. Thank you for joining us on episode 75 of our Verbal Journaling, and I'm your host, Luke O'Connor. Today's guest is a man who just completed the 100-day challenge. He is a dedicated family man, a wizard on a 41-inch piece of foam. He is a fantasy novelist. And he resides in the up-and-coming town of Port Macquarie. I wouldn't call it sleep anymore. It's a real buzz in that town, and we all know the epicenter of bodyboarding in which it holds. I'm talking to none other than Riptide rider Douglas Smith. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. I'm good. Thanks for having me on the show. And I actually don't ride a 41 anymore. I've upped the to a 42 and a half. So
boom.
Yeah, as you get older, you kind of start to fill out a bit more, and the board start to accompany those few extra kilos after having kids.
Dude, well, I think it's the only way to go. It's a smart way to go in my eyes. I've gone up in, yeah, probably almost 2 inches really, and I've definitely filled out a bit, put on some extra kgs. That, as you were saying, into your 30s and in a dad life, it's kind of inevitable, but I've enjoyed the bigger size boards, eh? I've enjoyed being able to throw them around and get more out of, like, the smaller stuff if you find yourself in it. I reckon it's sick. What about you?
Yeah, I think I kind of, like, trip on it now that I didn't pick up a bigger board when I was younger. I used to ride, like, narrow boards. I think I wanted to be a bit of tech and kind of mimic, you know, Nick Gornell and Joe Clark, just how they used to ride those narrow boards that they could whip around, but I kind of wish I had a bigger board when I was younger, because I feel like bigger boards just suit my physique, because I've always kind of been a bit solid, not like heavy, but I wish I did really have a bigger board, you know, especially surfing bigger waves. Yeah, you definitely need the extra volume behind
you. It's so funny you say that, eh? Because I have had the exact same train of thought over the last 3 or 4 years. And there was even a stage there in my early 30s when I wasn't enjoying bodyboarding as much. And I found that I was going, something's missing. Like, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not the most tech guy out there, and I'm definitely more happy to be in a barrel than on an air ball or above the lip. But I was just noticing that, like, I wasn't getting pop out of things. I wasn't getting the drive I needed. I was bogging reverses all the time. And, like, again, I'm not fully tech, but I could do a fucking reverse spin. And then when I went up an inch and then an inch and a half and almost 2 inches, everything came together. It just felt like I was more centered on the board. My knees and my quads weren't clipping on the end of the tail when I was trying to fling it around. It was a full game changer, and I'm exactly the same thought, train of thought of you. Why did I not do it earlier?
Mm. Yeah, I actually, where it was kind of like a light bulb moment, it was I was looking at Benno's, like Sam Bennett's pro models, and they were just that touch wider. And I used to see how he used to just, like, back in the day, and still when he does get on the board these days, now he still rips. But, like, especially in heyday, he was so technical. One of the most tech riders, definitely in the bodyboarding scene in my eyes. And his board was a bit wider, and that kind of, like, spun me out a bit, and then I kind of disregarded it. And then it just came up a few years later. I was talking to Charlie Holt, and yeah, he kind of just said, man, you should be riding definitely a bit wider board. And then it was like, oh my goodness, yeah, that's why didn't I do that when I first noticed it?
Yeah, and you're so right with Sam Bennett, man. He was the tech freak, the most stylish cat going around there falling, and obviously still is when you're hopping on the boog, as you alluded to. But it's like, going into my next point, Dougie, you know, you grew up in a fucking fierce generation of bodyboarders coming out of Port, bro. Like, you came up in the cream of the crop, and it would have been advantageous at times, and I reckon also really tough at times, because there would have been so much rivalry that would have pushed you guys, and you all surfed and booged so well. But what was it like growing up in that generation, and what was an average day down at Breakwall like?
It was pretty epic and a lot different to what it is now, that's for sure. I think having that competitive rivalry just pushed you so much harder, because I think when you are competing against your close mates, they are definitely pushing. They're in the exact same position, like looking at your surfing and how you're pushing them. So you can't constantly pushing each other every surf, every session at break. Or it's like, what did he just do? Okay, I have to do something like that, or better, or bigger, or I have to get a better barrel. So it was so competitive, but it just made you appreciate the art and the skill, and you kind of. I felt like that, yeah, coming from Port Macquarie, we were like this own little bubble. And I know it's in the Joker, Kingy talks about like this own little bubble where everyone's competing with each other, but it was so true. You know, we were all growing up and we weren't worried too much about what people were doing on the outside. We were so worried about like what our best mates were doing and how we could match that or do better. So it was pretty fierce, but at the same time, wouldn't change anything for it. And it was just the love of the sport and the competitiveness just kind of ignited that fire to just keep pushing our bodyboarding levels and our skills and, yeah, how we could take it up to the next level.
Who did you regularly surf with, bro? Like, who was it, like, the heads in the lineup when you would paddle out on the run out, so to speak?
It's kind of a similar crew what it is now. It'd be, like, if I was to paddle out back in the day, it would have been like Kingy, Groffy, Charlie, Chase, Jonesy, Benno, Eric Medcalf. That was kind of ones that I can like that still ring true in my mind of like the true kind of like breakwall rats. There was heaps of other kind of kids that were. Just as good and used to rip, but they never kind of made it outside the Port Macquarie bubble, so to speak. Like Nathan Branch and like Jesse Robinson, like all these names, not many people would have heard of. But man, back in the day, they were definitely up there with the kids that ripped and the people that ripped.
Those sort of names, yeah. Like I mean, Cronulla's definitely got names like that too. Like you might not have heard of a bloke named Luke Rogers, but when I was growing up around the Emerald Traps and the Alley and all the different reefs, like he was one of the go-to bodyboarders in regards to his style, the effortlessness in which he kind of like, you know, put moves down and the way he would just draw lines. Like everyone thought, oh, this is the next big thing, or he's the guy that you were just speaking of where you compete against constantly and trying to up the bar with. But no one outside of probably Cronulla would know him, and that sounds exactly the same as like the Nathan Branch or the Jessies that you were just mentioning, man. But it's so cool to hear that there is like such a community around good bodyboarding, and you know, still is, but those golden eras, man, like you had a world champion there in your hometown, like not just on prone, on DK too, that was just, he was an animal, man, and still is. But like, what was it like having you know, Kingy's tutelage just kind of smeared around all the port and everyone looking up to him?
It's pretty iconic. Like, you know, he still kind of is the face of Port Mac now that he's moved into real estate. I think he was kind of like the figure that everyone looked up to, because during that, the golden age, the heyday, man, he was unstoppable. He was surfing so technical and pulling into some of the heaviest barrels. So he was still pushing it so hard. And I think everyone just aspired to be like him and wanted to surf like him. So I think, and even on outside, he was just like his documentary, The Joker. He was this laughable and likable character that you kind of didn't want to verse against your heat because he was so ruthless. So it was something to definitely aspire and lead this breakwall rat pack that were from so many different families and so many different backgrounds, where he had just a similar background and growing up story. So it was really his story kind of hit home with a lot of the boys that used to hang around the beach then call Breakwall their home. And, yeah, it was pretty, I don't know. It's pretty cool to have that person to hang around and lead you in some sort of way.
Yeah, that's just, you can tell it's still going strong. Like everyone that comes out of there, has got the fire in their eyes. They've got the tenacity, eh? Like they go hard in whatever they do, and there's always that competitive edge. It's so like noticeable, even when it comes to the team challenge, man. Like, you know, I know you guys take that so seriously, and you know it's an unbelievable mantle to hold, because on the east coast of Australia, like, good bodyboarding is going down, and when you pull all these names out of the woodwork that you were just speaking about in regards to, like, the lesser known names, it's still rip. When they come together on those team challenge kind of formats, it creates such a competitive cauldron that it's insane. You guys often come out on top. Like, what's it like being part of the Ports team challenge team, and what's it like being in camp before a comp goes down?
It's pretty surreal, because, like, as you know, and everyone that listens to this podcast, bodyboarding is a very selfish sport. Like, it's all about yourself. Whereas, like, when you participate in the team's challenge, it's very selfless. Like, you're part of a team. And I guess it'd be a similar feeling to, like, footy players and stuff that have that team spirit, and, you know, everyone's working to win together. But with bodyboarding, it doesn't come around often at all. So I guess when team challenge does come around, it's so it just lights this different fire, this different competitive team spirit that we don't usually feel when we do bodyboard. If we were chasing and going to competitions, it's a very selfish, you know, in a good way. You know, people are very self-driven and want to achieve so much in and so many goals and accomplish whatever they desire. But when it comes down to teams, it's not really about yourself. It's about your team and the team spirit. Like, even before leading up to it, like, we have group chats and we go for group surfs and stuff just to build that team morality. And we go for dinner a few nights before and discuss what we're going to be doing. So it's such a different mentality to what we normally experience, especially like most of the guys on our team have done the world tour circuit. So it's something that they bring that competitive drive into a team spirit, which is very different, but also very exciting each year. And that's why we keep wanting to do and we keep wanting to win, because, you know, we don't get that team spirit much. So winning a team challenge is so epic.
Fuck, man, it honestly looks so sick. I've been a part of a couple, never been lucky enough to win. We might have won one year by default, but I definitely didn't put in regards to, like, quality surfing. I think I flunked a lot of my heats, but, you know, like, looking from, like, the outside in, bro, like, even, like, last year's team's challenge, you know, it was like big news in bodyboarding. Like, when, and I obviously, I'm not talking about it definitely reached international areas, but I mean, like, nationally, everyone knew that you guys won, and it was all over Instagram, the reels. I think Kingy was up there doing acoustics, like, in the pub after. What's been the best year, Dougie? Like, what's been the best team, or what's been the best victory for Port that you've been involved with?
Oh, look, I'd probably say, like, I've been a part of probably 80% of it, but I feel like there was one year where it was like each team was sponsored by a bodyboard shop. So I remember there was like an inverted team, like an inverted Sunshine Coast, inverted Port Stevens. There was a EBB West Oz team. I'm pretty sure there was a Victoria. But I don't think that was the best year, but there was some really big names. And I think Emerald had a team as well, and had Jared Houston. There's a few years everyone kind of used to bring in the big shots. And I think that's when I was in the team B then for Port Mac, when I was a bit younger. But I feel like last year was a pretty big accomplishment for our win, and such a good feeling, because we did lose it the year before to Newcastle, which they've just been our rival since day one, which it's been epic. Like, the rivalry is what, like, the rivalry with our best mates, you know, Newcastle team are our biggest rival, and, you know, we all laugh, but we also kind of like try to push better than them, and we watch them, we analyze their heats, and like, we do so much work, and it's just that competitive spirit within us here in Port Mac. But I feel last year was such a good feeling. I think for myself as well, because we lost the year before, and then last year I think we had Sunshine Coast, Gold Coast, we had West Oz, and other teams, and I don't know, it was a really good, there was good waves, and yeah, so, and I think this year's going to be looking like there's going to be pretty sick waves as well for Lighthouse, because it is coming up in about 4 weeks, and the banks are pretty sick, so hopefully the banks stick around.
And dude, fingers crossed.
Has some nice, sick surf.
Yeah, like a nice, like, I mean, like, you know, they're all, everyone's talking about La Nina this year, and hopefully we get a bit more east in the swell, and especially a lot more east than our winter last year. Fuck, man, it was dismal, you know, on all fronts. It felt like no one on the East Coast really scored last winter, so hopefully we get a reversal. And, yeah, the banks stay. And so you'd run between, I know, like, Lighthouse is a go-to because it picks up so much swell, but it's obviously got Breakwell in your back pocket too, eh?
Yeah, well, it's kind of it's really just wherever the surf's best, and like Breakwell just happens to have good waves all day, even when it's onshore. You know, there's good competitive waves all day, so it's just super consistent. And if it is a little bit bigger, it's still really contestable. Whereas Lighthouse, if it doesn't have banks and it's just a little bit bigger, it gets really tough to actually compete against. And with the southerlies that blow, it's just uncontestable, and it's not. It's not something you kind of want to watch for a bodyboarder. If you weren't in the competition, you would want to watch people ripping and kind of surfing the best waves that are available. So I know we always kind of get shunned upon, like, or just like there's always a bit of backlash with having a break wall, but at the end of the day, we're trying to do what's best for all the teams and like to make it as contestable as possible, not just picking somewhere that's going to favour us. Like, and I think that always, that comment always comes up if we have it at break hall, but we are just trying to do our best and make it contestable for everyone.
Really?
And that's why, Team Challenge is so good, because we actually do try to put the bodyboarders first and making sure we are getting the best waves. But yeah, it's just like, if something's not in favour for another team, you know, they do throw out those comments. But, you know, we've bent over backwards for this team's challenge every year, the competition every year. The whole PNBA comes together, like the canteen. Some of the folks in the canteen are working from sunrise to sunset, making sure that there's food always available. And there's people like us, like part of the club, are setting up and packing down. There's even like people staying or camping at the tents to make sure no one steals stuff. Like it's such a big organization, such a big production that no one really sees the behind the scenes. And we just get kind of sometimes, if the surf's not that good, or yeah, it's not at where someone thinks the surf is better, it's just those little comments just I don't know. Yeah, they just come up every year, you know.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. I had no idea, but dude, I can definitely see why, but I definitely hold your point in high regard there, man. I think that those kind of comments aren't really that warranted, because yeah, like Breakwall is one of the most contestable and prolific waves going around. Like, it's produced so many amazing bodyboarders, and to think that, who wouldn't want to be surfing, like, you know, a barreling, running, bowling right-hander into a break wall? Like, it's kind
of... I think it's when there's no lefts. When there's no lefts, that's when those comments tend to pop up about not having the competition either at Lighthouse or somewhere else, you know, where there's more options for left and right, you know, like it's, you know, let's face it, break wall is pretty dominated by right-handers. So if you can't surf right-handers that good, you're going to be going, oh, like, wish the comp was at Lighthouse. You know, we would have done so much better if it was more lefts, you know. So I think that always appears each year. But, you know, it's at the end of the day, everyone kind of sees that we're trying to do the best and we're not being biased, and we do everything we can to make everyone happy. And you can't please everyone. You know, even Mozart had these critics, so.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. But, dude, rocking up, say, at Pipe, and you're a WSL surfer, you know, and you're going, oh, sweet, I'm really strong at backdoor, but on my backhand of Pipe, I'm pretty avocado. And then you get a super west swell and Pipe's pumping and backdoors are closed out. You're like, fuck, mate, like, you got to go left and you got to adapt the conditions. I mean, just, yeah, just with that point, like I understand why they get they brought up, but it should be just shut down straight away. Fucking hell, serve the conditions and serve the wave in front of you, you know, like.
Yeah, and I think that's, like, if you've made the team, that obviously you've made the cut to being a standout bodyboarder, so it shouldn't really matter what direction you prefer. Like, obviously people do prefer away, but, like, you know, if you've made the team, it's a pretty cutthroat team. You should be able to go both ways and do moves and both hold ways. Your line on each, on yeah, both ways. So, yeah, I know, like, people just want to get what they're comfortable with.
Oh, for sure, man. There's always going to be negatives and positives out of anything. Man, you know when you just mentioned Kingy before and I was thinking back on some of your bodyboarding feats when you were a bit younger. I remember reading an article, pretty sure it was in Movement back in the day, in relation to you going over to Chopes with Simon Thornton. I don't know if Kingy went over with you too, but you got some serious bombs and a couple of quality beatings that blew both your flippers off. Am I remembering that correctly?
yeah, Kingy wasn't there. I went with Thordo. It was a pretty spontaneous trip.
Yeah, tell us about that, man.
Yeah, it was pretty gnarly. Like, I was kind of, I won't like drag it on, but it was, yeah, Thordo just needed to lift down to Sydney, and I just finished my HSC, and my grandparents had like an incentive for kids to finish out, like my siblings to finish our HSC. They'd give us $5,000, and yeah, so I just finished the HSC, got $5,000.
Fuck, shout out to your grandparents, brah.
Yeah, it's such an epic incentive to finish schooling, and, you know, it's something that I'm going to pass on to my kids. But anyway, I had that $5,000, and instead of going, and I was only 17 as well, so I couldn't go to schoolies up in Goldie. So I, thought I needed to lift down to Sydney, and I was like, sweet, I'll drive you down there. He paid me some cash, and my grandparents lived in Sydney at the time. So I was like, yeah, we'll just crash here. And then as I picked him up, he's like, oh, man, do you want to, like, come with us? And I was like, oh, like, kind of, okay, yeah, all right, stuff it, let's do it. So he's like, we'll just stop at the World Factory on the way and we'll pick up some boards, we'll take some boards over. And, yeah, so literally, like, within 2 days, I was on the flight to Tahiti. And I didn't really know. He showed me Wingua and stuff, and I was just like this, you know, fresh, I guess, year 12 graduate, and I just didn't know what Wingua was or what really swells. I was pretty, you know, in denial of big swells because of just, you know, just surfing choppy breakwall, you know, when swells came through. So I wasn't really aware of, like, periods and seconds and whatever. So, yeah, 2 days later, we're on our way to Tahiti, got over there, spent the first night at his mate's place in, I can't remember the capital. It's been so long since I've been there. Is it the Papeete? No. Anyway.
Oh, bro, I would have unfortunately
been. Yeah, I think. Yeah, so and then we went down there. The first day, it was like, I don't know, probably like five, 6 foot. And yeah, and he gave me this board, this brand new board as well. So it was like it was a Polypro 40-41 Science Baudet, and it was so stiff. It was like a plank of wood, and I was so used to having that bit of flex, especially scooping and stuff, and it being a left, and I definitely wasn't as comfortable with the lefts as I am now. Back then, because I just grew up surfing breakhorn. Yeah, and then the next day we got up, you know, dark. I don't even know what time was. I had fully lost track of time. It was just such a big blur of, like, okay, of time and days, and because everything just happened so fast. It was literally, like, by the time I was surfing breakwall too, when I was out Chopes, it was like 4 days. So it was just really, like, so much had happened within that fast pace 4 days. And then, yeah, paddled out. It was just me and Thordo, and we paddled the whole way out there. And Thordo's like, oh, looks like there's a couple bombs. I was like, yeah, oh, sweet. I couldn't even tell how big the waves were because it was still so dark. And then we got to the channel, and there was a couple coming through, and still, like, really surreal. Like, wasn't sure how big waves were and, like, where I was sitting. Like,
were you guys the first out there?
We were the only ones out there. We were the only ones out there. We're literally the only ones out there till about, I think we came in about 10 o'clock when I lost my board. Like, it was, another surfer came out. His name was Adam. He was, like, this Californian, like, charger dude. Lived at the point there with his girlfriend. Always wore a gaff helmet. Yeah, and I think it was Adam. Anyway, and, we were the only ones out. I think it was about 9, 10 o'clock. And,
Dougie, that is unheard of these days, man.
Yeah, it was psycho. It was, like, but it was picking up. Like, it wasn't that big. Like, when the sun came, like, first light came, I was like, oh my goodness, like, yeah, this is pretty solid. As I was getting waves, I could feel, like, as I was, like, scooping down it, it almost felt like I was going down a bit of a half pipe, and I was like, wow, this is actually kind of solid, like heaps of water underneath me in the barrels, there was heaps of space. I was like, oh my goodness, this is definitely pretty solid. And then, yeah, that bomb where I got the double page in movement, I think that was about, 9 o'clock. I just remember I was sitting next to Thorda, and Thorda was like, go, Doug, go. And I literally just didn't even think about it, didn't even think twice. And I just turned around, paddled. And it was, I still remember the whole wave in my head. Remember the tunnel vision, remember scooping in, remember sliding out. The whole sequence, I kind of slid out because the board was so stiff. And also my skill level for scooping left wasn't as great. And
you were an 18-year-old kid, really.
17.
17, man. In like macking, 12 foot chokes?
Yeah. I didn't know how big it was, right? And then I remember, like, got to the bottom of the wave, and I just remember looking at this room around me. And that iconic scene of the mountains and the channel and stuff, but there was just no one around. Except for Tim McKenna was in the channel taking photos. And, he got the whole sequence. And then I just remember after I had that view for like a split second, which I still remember now, just blasted, like absolutely blasted, shot me down to the reef. Both fins came off, lost my leash, and just got tumbled all the way across the reef. Got absolutely pumped. And what's funny was that because I already planned, I was going to Pipe, I already bought tickets to go to Pipe after Christmas. And this was like, the 12th of December, all this happened. So, like, it wasn't even planned. I was going to Sydney to have Chrissy with my grandparents, and then I was going to go out to Hawaii from there. But instead, I got to see him twice, right, before Chrissy. But yeah, what was funny, I was training up to it, and I remember, like, my mate said such a stupid little comment saying, oh, man, just be careful when you surf in big waves. Like, you know, when you're about to drown, your body kind of, all your organs, I don't know how true it is, but your organs kind of fail, and you're like, you shit and you piss yourself. And, like, he said that to me when I was, like, training for Pipe. Anyway, and then when I was when I got so smoked by this wave at Chopes, I shit myself a little bit. So, obviously, I started to panic. And then, I eventually got to the surface with no fins, just, like, these dangling fucking anchors.
And, dude, that's so much more dangerous when they become anchors, because you're trying to keep yourself above water and they are just getting swirled down around you, and it's like a fight for survival.
Yeah, and it really was, because then the next wave of the set, I think it was like a mag or two later of the movement, there was a double page of Thordo, and it was like just as crazy as my wave. And I was on the impact zone with two fins dangling beneath me. And I just remember swimming for my life. I didn't even worry about trying to put my fins on, and I just swam for my life. And I just got into the channel and got out of the way. But, like, that brief period. So this, it's crazy to think, like, all of this happened probably in a matter of, like, 30 to 45 seconds. And then it's like gasping for air. And then I had to go swim in and find my board, which I never found again, fully lost it. Never found again. But brand new science. Never found again.
Fuck, man. That must have been pretty big for that to get swirled away that quickly. Like, you know, like, from my understanding of Chopes, there's that big reef passage out there. It goes into a semi closeout, but then on the inside of that reef passage, it's not calm water, but I mean, and it's got currents, but you can manage your way around it, and you should be able to see a fucking board floating.
I probably spent like an hour looking for it, and like hadn't had any breaky or anything because we got out there like, and I was just following Thordo, like the Chopu God. And yeah, I was just so exhausted and hungry, just looking for a board for like an hour, walking along the reef, and just never found it. Pretty crazy.
That's crazy, man. And did you get to surf Chopes again, or was that the one and done?
No, we surfed again because I took heaps of boards over for Thordo to sell. I still had a board for me to use. So, yeah, ended up surfing again. It was definitely smaller, but still a couple of bombs, and there was more people. But, yeah, it was – but then I ended up going back the year after.
Sick. And yeah, how was that?
Yeah, it was epic. It was sick. Spent like 6 weeks there, surfed other ways other than Chopes, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, I've heard on a couple of different islands off Tahiti, there's so many, like a wide variation of waves, eh?
Oh, man, there's this wave that's like Black Rock on steroids, eh? It was so sick, and I was staying with this family that just couldn't speak English. Thought I just knew them from friends or I actually can't remember how he knew them, but like I lived with this family for like 2 weeks, and I just like they didn't speak any English. So, like, I was pretty, like, homebound, surfing waves every day, like, not speaking really to anyone and just, like, trying to learn the language, but, like, I just had no point of reference or, like, to talk to someone. It was a really cool experience. But when my mates came over, because I flew over with Thordo, and then Thordo went off to, I think he went off to America, and I was like, oh, I'm going to stay until my mates come over. And, yeah, they came over, I think it was like 2 weeks later. And then, yeah, it was so – I remember actually kind of tearing up and hugging because, like, obviously this was so before phones where you're like, where are you, man? Like there was no point of contact. I just knew a date that they were arriving, and then they ended up getting delayed. They nearly got departed because they were bringing more boards over for Thordo, and like they fully got interrogated. And
I thought they were bringing drugs over.
Yeah, or no, I think they were just a bit sus on like why one bodyboarder is bringing, you know, 10 bodyboards over.
Yeah, for sure. I know you're a bit weird, eh? It'd be like a Chappelle Corby kind of scenario.
Yeah, I think it was more like they were getting away with paying like a tax on like being and not being like a business and just selling them to kids on the street instead of like actually getting it like imported for a business to sell to a business. Like kind of, I think it was kind of like that. It was just a little bit stuff. I don't think it was drug related. Maybe it was. I don't know.
I was only mucking around. I know exactly what you're talking about because it's like. The country is just going, well, hang on, you've got to pay an import tax for this because we're going to have a slice of the pie if you make a sale here. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. So I think and when Thordo was like getting all these young Aussies to bring over 10 boards at a time, the evidence starts stacking up.
definitely will be stacking up. There'll be a couple of stacks of cash, you know, hidden away after those purchases. Let's put it that way.
Dude. Yeah, it's pretty cool. I never had to pay for my trip when I was over there because I thought I just looked after me. So it's pretty cool.
That's so cool, man. I never know you spent so much time in Chopes. And really, like, you know, from all accounts, and again, I'm devastated I haven't had the chance to be in my lifetime, but it seems like it's a place where you can't go there and get it uncrowded anymore. Like everyone's on every swell. There's a lot of people passing through. And obviously, as you said, there's other waves around the joint you can get to and explore. But Chopes itself being like the crown and the jewel. I mean, the jewel and the crown, sorry. Like it's, it's pretty devastating, eh, to know that it's not going to be like that anymore.
Yeah, it's kind of like I wouldn't say it's as equivalent, but it's almost like, something that will just never happen again. Like there's no way in my lifetime I will be able to do exactly what I did then now and come home with that exact same experience. There's no way that would ever happen. Like even if I hadn't had kids and I was at that age again, but to do that this time, it's such a different world to back then, and that's something that it'll just never. And there's a lot of things like that for a lot of bodybuilders within this sport. So many things that they would have experienced that would never, ever happen again. and that's just the way it was and the way the world goes, that, you know, more people catch on to these gems in the world, and they flock to it because they know how amazing it is. And, you know, it's the first people that jump onto these gems get to truly experience that fire that keeps them going back to that spot. Like Thordo, you know, Thordo lives over there now. He's got a wife, he's got a kid. You know, he's the god of chopes.
He is the god of chopes, eh? And he's still there at the moment?
Yeah, yeah. I think he was just back in Port for a little bit. I think it was last year maybe. Yeah, he had his kid here and went to school for a bit here. And then, yeah, he's gone back. And he just does like visits. Yeah.
What a lifestyle, eh? What a crazy man. Like, yeah, from all the footage and the photos you see of him, like, he is not afraid at all.
Yeah. Do you remember the bodyboarder Brett Lillyman?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Brett Lillyman were like, they just like that, like the rivalry that I spoke of Port. But obviously, Brett Lillyman wasn't from Port, but just that competitiveness with pushing each other. And I thought I told you so many stories of how Brett Lillyman used to push Thordo so hard at chopes. And, like, yeah, well, some of the stories were so hectic.
Fuck, but, gnarly.
Yeah, so I think Brett Lillyman was also one of the pioneers of chopes, but obviously life took him on a different journey. But Thordo just kept the Tahitian waters, just kept Thordo.
kept him going. Moana. Yeah, cruising. Did you say Moana?
Yeah, Thordo's the Moana of Tahiti.
Fucking hell, man. Do you watch that show with your groans?
I try to stay clear of, like, man, it's just, I don't know, screen time's so bad for kids, eh? Like, I try to do my best. It's hard. It's very hard in this day and age. But, yeah, it's definitely, it was a movie that I did watch with them, like, age. Oh, actually, I don't even know if I've watched it with them. I don't know. But I know I've watched it.
Yeah, oh, man, I love it. So, yeah, dude, tell me about your screen time with the kids. Like, do you have a strict routine with them, and or, like, they can't watch it at all? Like, what's the go?
I don't know. Just, like, because being I'm a teacher of special ed, and I obviously, like, I see the next generation, whether they do have learning difficulties or they are on their own paths. Like, I just see the amount of screen time can just be so devastating to their development. And I guess I just don't want that for my kids. I know it's something that we have to, it's just part of the world, right? Like, yeah, part of something we grow up with. But I guess the more we can keep that natural development for the kids, more of that face-to-face interaction, more of the actual person-to-person love, feelings, touching, laughter, all those kind of experiences, as much physical as possible for as long as possible, I think that will set a good moral groundstone for the kids as they get older, and they will learn how to not indulge in screen time but learn how to manage their screen time a lot more beneficial. And I think having those morals and values will definitely help at a younger age and carry that out through school life. Because at school, I see it now, they use laptops and iPads and stuff, but, you know, it's using that for education purposes, which is I'm not against at all, but I think I am against some parents that just stick an iPad in it because that's easy. And I think if it's easy now, it'll become harder later. So I think we try to just limit screen time as much as possible.
Yeah, yeah, sweet, man. But is there, like, you know, I don't want to pry, but, like, with your...
Oh, it's a routine.
Yeah.
Not really. Like, there is, like, we've got surrounded in our house, we've got books everywhere. Like, I've got my own library in my study.
Sweet.
I've got, yeah, so we built, like, custom shelves for all my books. And then in kids' rooms, like, on their beds, they've got bookshelves. And out in the lounge room, they've got bookshelves as well. So there's books literally everywhere. So instead of, like, screen time, we do try to advocate, like, either reading together, colouring in, or even just, like, independent play, like playing with dollhouses. My wife built this amazing custom dollhouse for the kids to play with. So we definitely try to limit screen time and try to navigate it through other, passive play or passive activities where can, read, write, or colour in, or not right because they're not that old yet. But doing, yeah, so after dinner, just read for a bit and then, yeah, chuck them into bed.
That's so cool, man. That's really good. I love to hear that because, yeah, screen time is a pretty – it's a necessary evil at times, but it's – yeah, it's hectic the way it shapes and forms young people's minds these days and even ourselves, like just being addicted to your phone at the end of the day or flicking through things when you're bored. Like we're not very good at just sitting with ourselves anymore and our thoughts and our you know, and our mind processes, and we just kind of resort to some sort of addiction to preoccupy us. So yeah, man, it's really cool to hear. So you're a teacher at Port Mac. Is it high school or primary?
No, it's like an independent school, but we have a site off a Catholic school. Yeah, it's a non-profit organisation called Autism Spectrum Australia. Yeah, we teach specifically autistic students.
Sweet, man. And what are the challenges you face there and what are the rewards?
Rewards, it's different every day. Kids are, you build some pretty strong relationships with the kids, which is, I guess, something. I've worked a lot of different industries in my life, and some of the relationships that you build, like professional relationships that you build with the students, are pretty, pretty strong and unique. You get to, the reward is as well that I think you have. It seems like it's something weird to say, but like you have such a self-reflection period of your time where you kind of self-reflect on your life and like, oh, my life isn't actually that bad. Like, and I'm not saying that we should like say, or from someone else's struggle that we can look at our own lives, but like, yeah, sometimes you think that your life is tough, but some people have it so hard. And I think being part of the process to making sure that their emotional development, their social emotional development is going to lead them for an independent life is so rewarding, especially when you see them like when they finish school and they're just like part of society, just kicking away, doing what they love or just being who they are. That's a pretty warm feeling that I would definitely not get from making a cup of coffee in a cafe. But also, comes the ups, there's a lot of struggles with that, so you do deal with a lot of behaviors, and those behaviors it doesn't necessarily mean like your physical like hitting behaviors, but more so like you deal with a lot of mental health behavior, like a lot of, and that's what I've seen more on teenagers lately, the mental health, there's so much support for mental health for teenagers, and that's definitely some of the challenges as well, because growing up without screen time, like we just introduced like these Yonder pouches where we have to lock up these phones for the school period. And like there's some, like we spoke about like the addiction, right? They've had these phones for so long and you just see how addicted they are to these devices. And yeah, you do see a lot of mental health challenges. Obviously, I'm not going to go into detail on a lot of them, but they're definitely some of your tiring days. You just like any kind of work, you have your really tough days, but then you have your epic days, right? So, but you always without my line of work, you always have. I've noticed that you'll always have your one student that would just just bring a sick smile to your face just with what they say to you, and like the relationship I was saying to you, you know, they hold that light when things get a bit dark. So it's pretty cool. Industry, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Fuck, you explained that so well. And yeah, I guess there's a lot of rewards at the end of challenging periods, eh? And like you probably get a really good a really good kind of sense of accomplishment and helping someone out, like, you know, kindness and caringness and compassion within your role too, because like there'd be, yeah, you'd be working in some difficult situations, but the outcomes when they do fruit, so to speak, it'd be really rewarding. My wife also works in special needs departments in high schools, and she's done on and off for the last 10 years. She's currently, she's 33 weeks pregnant, so she's almost out of it.
Congrats.
Yeah, yeah, I know. all happening. But yeah, so she's also worked in those departments, man, and she often comes home and tells me about like some of the, as you were just discussing, the mental health issues, but also some of the really cool days where, you know, after 10 weeks of the term, you know, kind of working with a certain student on a certain issue and then seeing the results down the line, it's really rewarding. So that's really cool, man. But thinking, you know, I'm hearing all this from you, and you obviously got a jam-packed life with like your two kids, your family, bodyboarding, obviously a hectic job. But how do you find time to write? Because you write so well and you've been doing so many cool articles for Riptide that, like, I'm wondering, how are you pumping this out at night? Like, are you on Ritalin, bro? Are you on a bit of-
No, I don't know. I've always been pretty disciplined with writing. I think from doing uni, like there was this self-discipline that I kind of embedded into my practice every day. So before, when I finished my first novel, I was up every morning, 5 o'clock, writing, editing, doing everything I can before kids woke up or before everything started, before the day started. So I kind of do that. Last couple of weeks, actually, so this year has been pretty dismal in the mornings because I've been doing this 100-day challenge. So that's kind of been taking up my mornings for each day. But now I get all of my writing done at night because the kids go to bed pretty early, like 7 o'clock. So it's nice to have that. And my wife works nights as well. So, like I work during the day, she works at night. So we kind of tag team out. She works nights. And, yeah, it just having that time after the kids are bed, that's where that self-discipline comes, where I sit down, do what I need to do. I always have like a list next to my, or like a book that has a few notes that I need to get done and dates I need to do them. And yeah, just kind of sit down and do them. So yeah, appreciate you liking the Riptide articles. And yeah, I've been getting a few comments and messages saying that, yeah, the article's been pretty cool and something just like different for that side of Riptide, and it's cool to see.
Dude, it's so good. It's the thing that it's needing and like missing for so long, you know what I mean? And to pump them out so regularly, much like in a kind of Stab-esque kind of way, you know what I mean, with like their platform and you know, having the really good material there on the happening like the happening situations in bodyboarding, like, you know what I mean, not just of past pieces or of like, you know, historical data or like whatever it is, or like, you know, an opinion piece, actually bringing up what's happening at the time. So it's sick, man. And so did you go to uni and study journalism? Is that what you were
looking at? I did creative writing and English lit.
Sick.
Yeah, so actually I did a Bachelor of Arts in sociology. And I don't know if you know much about sociology, but it's just studying society, really, and like just behavior patterns, and it's kind of
a little bit of anthropology.
Yeah, it's kind of what I do now in class, but at a small scale, really. But it's just like studying behavior of society, and yeah, I don't know. I just like I was doing that, and then my girlfriend at the time, her brother, I was really good friends with. And like before we got together, good friends with him, and he showed me Lord of the Rings, and I'd always been like a fantasy guru, like always loved fantasy, like I read heaps when I was younger, and funny enough, I didn't read much of Lord of the Rings and stuff. I didn't read Lord of the Rings when I was younger. I kind of fell into the Harry Potter magic realism side, but yeah, then my mate at the time was like, look, I think you'd really like Lord of the Rings. Let's watch it. So we watched the whole thing, the extended version from the Fellowship of the Ring to Return of the King. And then The Hobbit was coming out. So the first Hobbit movie came out. Anyway, so I ended up diving into this world and I just fell absolutely in love. And I kind of like had another light bulb moment. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is something I could do. This is something I've loved and been a part of my whole life. Like, I feel like I could write this. And I've always been pretty good with English. Like, yeah, I've always loved words and, yeah, so it just kind of came naturally. And then I wrote the first draft of a novel, and it was pretty much like a chew and spew of Lord of the Rings. But then I was like, I need to, like, it was probably about 150 pages. I still have it. And yeah, it's just, yeah, chew and spew of Lord of the Rings. And then I was like, oh my goodness, I need to actually learn how to write a book. And then I was studying sociology at the time, I looked at if I could study creative writing, and yeah, funny enough, stars aligned and I could study creative writing. So swapped my major, studied creative writing. I was like, well, I better learn some English lit. And yeah, so studied English literature, read heaps and wrote for like 2 to 3 years, and yeah, finished that. And I actually ended up still majoring in sociology because I already done enough subjects. So I majored in sociology, creative writing, and English literature. But now I'm also, on top of my big schedule, day-to-day schedule nowadays, I'm also doing my master's. So, which is...
Wow.
Yeah, for English teaching, secondary English teaching.
So, is that something you'd want to take to the schools?
Yeah, 100%. Like, at the moment, I write all the English programs for, like, it's Autism Spectrum Australia. So, like, the whole school-wide, they all use my English programs now. So, yeah, it's definitely something I want to embed into the school and my day-to-day practice. So, it's, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Sick, man. Dude, that's so cool you mentioned Lord of the Rings. I'm a huge fan. Also, my dad has been a huge fan for a very long time and went to see all the movies when they first came out every summer. Down on Christmas holidays at Ulladulla at our holiday house at Narrawali, and you look forward to them so much. It was such a dear time in our life. It was a real special thing. And I remember him getting me the series. He had another set of books, but like when the new revamp books came out, 1, 2, and 3 and all that sort of stuff. It was It's such a crazy journey to go on. Like, one, admiring what Tolkien did and how he pretty much wrote another language and created another world that was so intricate and so, like...
lifelike. It's so real. It's so real. Like, he wrote it. But he was also I know heaps about Tolkien and the lore behind it because I just fully absorbed my whole life around Tolkien.
And his son?
No, I didn't really tap into his son. I don't know. I just like obviously he has a similar voice to him, but I just
didn't you finish off like The Return of the King?
No. Yeah, Tolkien finished. It was all one book, and Tolkien submitted that to the publisher, and the publisher said, no, that's too big. We need to cut it into 3 books.
What about the Silmarillion?
Silmarillion was written by J.R. Tolkien. That was like he wrote that just after because that was like his Bible.
That's what I thought because that was almost like rehashing all the different characters and all the different realms and all the different – intertwined stories that I was speaking about beforehand that actually laid out, like the before and afters of the Lord of the Rings, so to speak.
I actually went to like a lot of the sites that they filmed in New Zealand by myself.
Sick.
It was just one summer. I was like, you know what, I'm just going to hire a camper van and just drive around New Zealand by myself. And
was this, you didn't have a family or a wife yet?
No. This was during uni. I just had no responsibilities, no nothing. So I was like, you know what, I'm doing it. So I hired a camper van, just drove around New Zealand, spent 3 weeks on the North Island, and just went to all the kind of spots where they filmed all the different locations. Did this like crazy 12-hour hike to go to the top of Mount Doom.
Wow, where's Mount Doom at?
It's Mount Tongariro on the North Island.
Hectic.
Yeah, it's like to get there from one side, it's like a 2-hour hike, but like to go to the full hike where it finishes on the other side, it was like, 12 hours and like I saw lava moving. It was psycho. It was so surreal. And that's why Peter Jackson picked New Zealand for Middle Earth because it is such a, small piece of what Tolkien would have envisioned Middle Earth to be like, which is crazy.
So cool, man. Yeah, so cool to hear you speak about it. You're obviously very passionate about it. It's a great series, and it's a great it's just great literature, isn't it? Like, it's so in depth with everything he says in those stories. Like when he describes Smeagol, Gollum, like in just the way, like, you know, in those first instances when when Bilbo comes I guess into his cave, like stumbles into his cave, and just the way it all kind of goes from there, and like the riddles and how he actually guesses it in the end. It's psycho, really. Like, it's, yeah.
It is, yeah. And this will kind of be like my last like thing. Like, I could literally talk about Tolkien, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit all night. But I do have like two like special editions of The Hobbit that I think they only released, I think it was about 100 of them. I've got two of them, and it's the cover is Tolkien's drawing of the Desolation of Smaug. Like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's actually Tolkien's drawing on the front cover of what the Desolation, like the Smaug, Smaug destroying Lake Town.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's his drawing. They only made like 100 of those editions for The Hobbit, and I've got two of them.
Fuck, how much did you pay for them, do you mind me asking?
$1.
What?
Yeah, I got them from Op Shop here in Warhope. I literally got it, saw it, and I was like, oh, this is wild. Like, this has to be worth something. Looked it up, and I was like, holy, I can't believe I just found this for like $1. Anyway, and I think it was like months later, I went back to the same Op Shop here in Port Macquarie, and they had another copy of it. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. And I just, because that's where I got most of my books from Op Shops. And yeah, so I got two copies of the same Hobbit from the same Op Shop.
That is uncanny, man. That's
bizarre. Yeah, I've got one of them framed in my room.
Shout out to Warhope, babe, getting it.
Yeah.
That's amazing, bro.
Yeah, I know. Like, I wonder what journey they've had.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, hold on to them for a long period of time because, you know, down the line, if there's only 100 copies of them, it's gonna ramp up the value.
Well, they're not. I think I looked at the price for them. I think it was like last year or the year before, and they weren't worth that much. I think they were worth like $200 or something. You know, which is pretty expensive for a book, but like, it's not like, you know, finding a Bitcoin for $900 and then now stumbling upon it. And it's worth, you know,
60K or something.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not like that, but it's still, it's the like, it's still a valuable piece to have on my library at home.
Fucking oath, man. Yeah, fucking oath. What about bodyboarding vintage mags or any sort of, like, you know, memorabilia you've kept from back in the day? Is there anything you've got framed up, or, like, obviously that movement mag, or any old rippies that you've held on to?
Funny enough, I don't have anything, eh? I really should have like old bodyboards and old movements of when I first got the double page, and, you know, even to when I got the double page at Supers with Ray Collins, like his photo book I should have bought, but I was so stingy back then when it came out. I was on a university student wage, and I just couldn't fathom to buy magazines, and so I don't know, I should have more stuff, but I've got heaps of digital copies, but like we've said, you know, physical copies are so good. But yeah, I don't have anything.
Wow, that's blown me away for someone who's so English and literature. I mean they've happened, they're moments in time, you've experienced them, you know, like the photos are nice and it's always good to look back on memories, but you always have them in your head, won't you?
Yeah, it's funny, like I think when it was all happening, like you caught up in those times, those good times, you know, you don't really know that these are the best times, the good times, and you don't know that you need to kind of cherish these moments because you're so caught up in this wave or this motion of like everything's like so sick at the moment. You don't really have that self-reflection and go, oh, wait, hold on. I need to grab some stuff here because I think I might need this later to reflect on. And, you know, it is what it is, right? Like, you don't, no one tells you when they're the good times, so cherish them. You just, I don't know. Just a Yeah,
and you're almost too cool at the time too, man. I remember some things. Even my dad had these moments. He played like a really good high level of rugby league and played like a couple of games for the Bulldogs when they were called the Berries and mostly reserve games. Yeah, yeah. Like fucking loved it. Grew up in Connell Park just on, in the Canterbury Bankstown region and you know, loved it, man. It was a great footy player and I only saw dad today. Like I hang out with him all the time. He's such a big part of my life. But and obviously mum too, but like just I remember him always saying to me, yeah, like, you know, keep your photos, keep your articles, keep anything that you are involved with at the time. Not so much for, you know, an ego stroke or to kind of puff your chest out, but more so like just to have those memories as you go. Because he regrets a lot of things of like not, you know, getting those team photos he was in or holding on to trophies and stuff. And you know, there's a bit of a give and take. You can't hold on to fucking everything, but there's those kind of like a handful of things you really should try and grasp onto. And, you know, sometimes we do, sometimes we don't, but it's always stuck with me and I try and keep as much as possible. And oh, I've lost heaps of shit too, but it's funny how like, yeah, you're so right. At the time, you just cruise and you think this is going to be your life forever. I remember driving up and down the coast and I was like 21 going, fuck, I'm doing this for the next like forever. Do you know what I mean? Like no thought in my mind that like a full-time job, a mortgage, family, responsibilities, anything was going to come in my way. I'm like, fuck that. I am just free bird at the moment, Leonard Skinner style, and I'm hitting the highway.
Yeah, and it's you know, it is kind of like as your dad was saying, it is kind of like sad that we don't actually hold on to those moments and stuff. But I don't know, I still feel it now, you know, like I don't like really, I've always been kind of like a bit reserved on that side. I'm not really a big bloater on like what I've accomplished or what I've done. I don't really like I've had a few people saying to me, oh man, you should have that Chopes photo. If I had that Chopes photo, I'd have that huge on the wall in my lounge room. And I'm like, it's a bit dicky. Like, I don't know. I've just never really had that kind of ego to show off that kind of side of like my achievements and stuff. But like it's, I wish I kind of was, because there's been some huge highlights that I would definitely have held on to nowadays, you know, to obviously not for myself, but maybe even to show like my kids and go, yeah, that was me at Chopes. Can you guys believe that? But kind of, I don't know, in that sense, but I've got, I don't know.
Yeah, you can honestly probably still get it blown up. It's probably not too late. I know what you're saying, though. I know it's like the, you don't want to put yourself out and be like the center of attention or kind of stuff. But I do think there is something in remembering those serious moments and more so even just for the mystique of the moment, Dougie. You know, like for you to be there in like a tropical fucking wonderland in the Pacific that just gets hammered by a swell, and you to be one of the most world-class slabs, like world-renowned slabs now in this day, there with like three other people or whatever it was. Like that's a memory of itself, bro.
Well, that's it, you know. It's a memory. It's something that like, you know, they're 17 and I'm 35 now. Almost 20 years later, I still remember it clear as day. You know, like it's something that I'll hold on to, that whole journey I'll hold on to for the rest of my life, because it's just something I picture. I don't know, it'd be nice to hang around, but it was something like, and funny enough, talking about this whole like bloating thing about like achievements and stuff, I recently just did like an application for Australian Survivor.
Wow, sick.
Yeah. Yeah, and like part of the criteria is I kind of talk about your achievements and why would you be a good candidate on Australian Survivor, et cetera. And so like I kind of had to step outside my comfort zone and be like, okay, well, yeah, this is what I kind of done and this is who I am and this is why, X, Y, and Z.
So yeah, it's kind cool. of... Dude, that'd be so sick to see on that show, especially after watching the 100 Day Challenge. You were dedicated there. I know Survivor would be the next level up, but fuck it, man. You got to throw your hat in the ring and see if you can do it.
Yeah, well, that's it, you know. Like, why not? You know, I've watched the seasons before and it doesn't look any – like the only thing that would be probably a struggle is the, I guess, winning – people over and being conniving and manipulative. Because
that's
I'm
a hard thing, eh? But then yeah, you've got the kind of thing in your back pocket too, man, you know?
Yeah, for sure. But I think to be manipulative like that, it's going against the grain in my beliefs and stuff. But I don't know. Either way, if I got on there, it'd be fucking epic. It'd be a pretty cool experience. So I don't know. I'm not expecting everything, but it's just cool. Just like what we're talking about, you know, just being kind of proud of what you have accomplished and showcasing that is definitely something we should, I don't know, I guess I should probably do more, but it is.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just a balance, man. It's the balance of like not being too proud, but then also being proud of yourself. It's a fucking hard one. And everyone on social media these days is pretty quick to try and tear you down other than to pump you up. So, Yeah, fucking oath, man. It's a real difficult one. Thinking about Survivor, bro, you might be back on a 41.5-inch board after doing like 3 or 4 weeks out. They're hectic.
Just eating rice and beans.
Fucking hell. Like that'd be one way, you know, you don't need to lose weight. I'm not saying that. But if anyone wanted to go out there and, you know, put themselves through the test, that's the ultimate test. Do you know where this one's going to be?
No, he didn't say in the application. They asked, I don't know if you watched the last season, it was like it's Titans versus Rebels, but this season that I applied for, it's Heroes versus Villains. So, I said I was a bit of a hero, but even then, it's so dicky. Yeah, I'm a hero.
Yeah, I know, but you got to definitely got to categorize yourself. And as you said before with your morals, you're not like a villain because you'd have to be that conniving, kind of manipulating, backstabbing kind of person. So yeah, spot on.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting filling out the application. They do ask some pretty confronting questions and stuff about your life and that. So it's pretty cool. And you know, if I get through, I get through. If I don't, no gain, no loss.
Yeah, 100%, man. Yeah. It's like, why not throw your hat in the ring? It's so silly to think you wouldn't. You know, if you really want to do it, like there is
$500,000.
Sorry.
For $500,000.
Fuck.
Yeah, if you win Survivor, it's $500,000, which
that's
is
sort out like, the mortgage, eh? Happy days.
Just.
Yeah, I know. Oh, yeah, for sure. It's probably fucking half of people's mortgages these days. But, like, you know what I mean? That goes a long way.
They're still better off, you know. But, yeah.
Way better off, yeah. Fuck, that's it.
Yeah, so it's, yeah, I don't know. It'd be cool, but, yeah, if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
Well, then if it doesn't, man, you'll just be winning the Ports team challenge anyway, so fuck it.
It's not half a mil, but, you know, it's definitely a trophy over Newcastle.
Yeah, and it's a fucking good night at the pub with the fellas and you know, singing We Are the Champions with King in the background and acoustic, just carrying on.
Yeah, pretty much. That pretty much sums up team's challenge.
So good, man. Oi, Dougie, man, I really want to thank you for coming on, bro. I've had such a good time chatting with you and just getting to know you a bit better and obviously seeing the different sides here, because obviously I only known you really as the boog and obviously a really good writer too, but there's so many other sides here that I didn't know. And it was great recapping some of the times you've experienced on the boog and just what it's like to be in the community at Port Mac. I've always wondered that from Cronulla, like there's always been a mini rivalry there too. So it's great to hear from behind enemy lines, so to speak, what's going on down at Breakwell, bro.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. I mean, it's been good to chat. And yeah, I think a lot of people don't like, and it's like everyone has their own stuff that's going on. So yeah, it's kind of cool just to showcase. Yeah. I've got a bit more of the surface deep part of the Port Mac Teams Challenge crew that end up being fierce each year and winning and dominating. But it's good to have this chat. And yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been sick.
Yeah, bro. Let's fucking do it again and keep pumping out those articles, because I need some shit to read when I'm on the downtime. You know what I mean?
I've got eight ready. Oh, sorry, six ready to go. And I've got heaps, and like I've got more coming in. It's just like I don't have access to post them. So if I had access to post the articles, I'd be doing it like every 2 or 3 days. So it's just having access to do that and the time for like whoever who's posting and uploading it. yeah, so I've got a huge bank ready to go, which with some sick articles, with some pretty cool stories, and yeah, I just want people to start reading them, but it just takes time to get through that gatekeeper.
Yeah, oh, for sure, man. Yeah, with the podcast can be the same, but I guess it's a big moving team with, like, you know, a limited number of staff. Like, it's just, and it's also like people from the outside in probably don't realize that looking in. Sorry, it's a passion project. No one's really getting paid, so to speak. So it's all within your time, and like it's all
yeah exactly.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's kind of all from the heart, which is so epic, but then it's, like, hard to, you know, when you're getting properly paid for something. I'm not saying there's, like, you know, not small perks here and there, but when you're properly getting paid for something, there's an expectation on your role, or when you need to deliver something, there's that monetary value on it, where when it's that passion project and that good thing behind the scenes that we're all just trying to do for the just for the community, it's like there's that give and take, you know?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, so it's just we do it for the love of it, and we do what we can, and that's it, right? And that's, hopefully it grows into something bigger and better. But for the time being, with the small staff that's working within Riptide, it's just, yeah, hopefully builds up and up from that.
Definitely, man. Yeah.
But I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, what are your thoughts on Kingy not being in the Shark Island Challenge?
Oh, it's been on everyone's lips, man. Kingy obviously has a resume not like many other people, and he is a world-class bodyboarder and has won arguably the most gnarly Shark Island Challenge that has ever been held. So he's got all the rights to be in the comp. I guess the couple reservations that we have had as a committee, like myself, Mark Sather and Sam Venn, about him being in the comp is that when we first offered him a position, he did come back with some dates. He was unavailable during the waiting period, from the 23rd of May to the 30th of June. And then it kind of simmered down, and he wasn't really that fussed on being in the comp in our opinion. Because of probably thought it was just going to be another Shark Island Challenge that kind of ran on past. And, you know, I guess over the last 6 months there's been a gradual build-up to this comp, and we've got some big names in the lineup. Mm. So the competitive fire, and Kingy stoked up once more and he wants to be in it, which, man, we'd love to have him in it. It's just the logistics of him being away for a certain period. Like, for example, Ryan Hardy speaking to us at the moment, and Hardballs would be in there in a second, but he's got three Bali bodyboarding camps during that period. And so if we were to commit to him as a rider and have him in the comp straight away, you're
just backup surfers then? Like,
yeah, we've definitely got backup surfers, but we kind of want to put surfers in there that are just going to be available pretty much there and then, you know, like it's one of those things. And look, Kingy could still get a spot, bro. There's definitely no, like, the door hasn't completely shut. It's just that there's so many moving parts behind the scene and so many things that kind of come into it. And, dude, be perfectly honest, like, we have copped so much fucking
crap. Yeah, I know. That's why I wanted to ask you, because, like...
Oh, man. And
yeah, it's especially when he dropped that little reel of that video of him looking at all the old clips of him winning and all that. And, like, oh, shining.
We're sweet with that, though, Dougie. Like, we're so sweet with that. Actually, we encouraged that, because that was actually really good traction.
But I think it probably brought the attention more that he wasn't in it. And I think, is that what brought up a lot of...
No, man. My point was that actually we've been getting tarred with a brush in regards to a heinous brush about having too many old fellas in the comp, bro. So with Kingy being over 40 and, you know, I mean, look, dude, he's still fit as fuck and he's still rampaging. I mean, he doesn't bodyboard that much anymore. He's usually on a stick, which, you know, we all go through.
Yeah, he still boogs heaps, eh? He still, like, bodyboards heaps.
Yeah?
Yeah, he still boogs around port so much. Like, when the waves are good, which they, like, to be fair, the waves haven't been that good lately, but, like, yeah, he's been booging heaps. Still rips.
Yeah, oh, man. Definitely still does. But my point being is we've actually been told that we've got too many old fellas in there and we need a younger generation coming through. And it was really hard to make sure that the lineup is split kind of evenly with over 30s and under 30s. And with the trialists at the moment that we've got going, it should be almost an even split of 25 competitors, 12 under 30 and 13 over 30. So that was also in consideration. But we actually enjoy Kingy harping on a line because it only just creates more noise for the comp, and it's free advertising, eh?
Yeah, for sure. How come there isn't a Shark Island trial like it used to be? Like, you know, it used to be a point and it used to be sick, like, you know, like full competition of, yeah, and I think who the top four maybe used to get into the comp, or even just the first place used to win it. And
do you really want to surf the point to get into the Island Challenge?
Man, if it's well, like I was talking to Chase about it the other day, and like, you know, he's been pretty, probably the last like 6 to 8 months, he's been pretty low key with chasing waves and stuff. Like, yeah, he did do that Sumatra trip, but like I guess that's where the criteria kind of makes it a bit hard, because there are some guys that would love just giving that day to push themselves in that trial competition, because that's what it used to be. They just given that time to shine at the trials.
I know, but that criteria, Doug, in our opinion, I mean, everyone's got their own, and I definitely hear what you're saying, but why would you put someone who's going to surf a 4-foot burger that barely barrels out to one of the world's slabbiest, you know, heaviest waves and expect them to perform? I mean, it definitely in the past has been good bodyboarders that have won it and have gone on and performed well at the Island, but in our opinion, if you put a digital resume together and show us that you can...
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
...then put slabs. But look, I definitely see your point of view, because you're coming down on a competition day, you've got to ramp up, you've got to push through. Like, look at the WSL, you've got the QS, you've got to surf for fucking months on end to then get to the big leagues to do it.
Yeah.
It was also, man, a logistical thing on our end about resources, man. The comp hasn't run in 6 fucking years, man. No cunt out there actually realizes how hard it was to get money together for companies to come on when they've gone, oh, you've had a competition run for 20 years and then it stopped for 6 years and you want us to invest money into it after COVID and cost of living prices and all sort of shit happening to try and get it off the ground and then support you guys. We don't have any content to go off in the last 6 years, and it's just been this floating fucking boat out into the ocean that everyone's forgotten about, you know?
Yeah, and that's what makes it hard. It kind of reminds me, like, I know it's on a completely different scale of waves wise, but like, there's the Teams Challenge. Like, the Teams Challenge is backed by PNBA. Like, PNBA does so much for that event to run, like organize sponsors and do all that. So maybe like future, it might have to be like the Cronulla, like the bodyboard club is doing stuff for the Shark Island Challenge to make sure that the sponsorships keep... I don't know, it's just an idea, but that's kind of the way I see it with Shark Island Challenge.
We've made our own bodyboarding club, man. It's called the Shark Island Challenge, like bodyboarding.
Oh, sick.
Yeah, yeah. Because we're registered through Surf New South Wales and Surf New Australia, and we're all through their affiliated insurances and indemnity policies. So that's how we actually got a lot of the connections and went through the correct avenues. This has been in the pipeline for the last like 12 months. But yeah, with King in the trials, man, like definitely worthy points to bring up. But you just can't have everyone in the comp, and
yeah, 100%.
It's just one of those things, eh? Fuck, it's
time. Does that mean there's gonna be a Cronulla like a Shark Island Challenge team for next year's team challenge?
I don't know, man. I don't know. We don't want to step on the toes of Desi, and I think. Desi at Emerald last time he sent up a team, the boys kind of carried on and had a good time and probably didn't really take it as seriously. So I think that's why they're not there this year. That's what the word on the grapevine is anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But it's so like, and we actually had a PNBA team challenge meeting last night, just talking about all the back behind the scenes stuff. And yeah, we're talking about next year and opening it up to like 12 teams, because we're getting interest from like Tassie, New Zealand, and then I think, and Cronulla, like potentially next year. So like opening up more spots for more teams, because yeah, I feel like there's been a full circle with bodyboard clubs in Australia, which is so epic to see.
Yeah, definitely. Have you seen the new stuff that's happened down the Gold Coast?
Yeah, and like Gold Coast didn't have a team to come up, but they said they want to lock in for next year, which is so sick because there hasn't been a South Coast team in so long. So, which would be so cool, and it just goes to show that there's bodyboarders still attending monthly competitions and doing all that and keeping the bodyboard light lit, which is really cool because, like, growing up and like what we touched on before about the younger generation is definitely not as strong. Like in Port Macquarie, I dare say it's just not as what it used to be. But yeah, hopefully this rebirthing of all the clubs builds up the next gen.
For sure. Why do you reckon that is? Why do you reckon the next gen isn't there?
Just don't think there is definitely some next gen boogers for sure, but man, look back at, like, say me growing up, the next gen was fierce, was stylish. There were all round boogers, and there were so many bodyboarders from all different parts of the coast. Like, I remember the Gold Coast, there was like your Ash Bryant, your Joe, your Tom Wilson, your Tom Smith, your Rob Laurie. All that, and that was just like from small part of the coast, and then like you go down a bit further, and then there was the Port Mac, and there was the Coffs. There was so many younger next gens coming up, but I feel, I don't know, like I feel like there's definitely not that as much hype around bodyboarding as much as there was, because surfing is so dominating. Like, it dominates mainstream media, it dominates mainstream conversation. So it's such a, it takes up a huge. I guess if you look at like a Venn diagram, it just takes up so much of the bodyboarding potential for it to be something big again, which is sad because, like, yeah, heaps of grommies ride surfboards here in Port, and we're meant to be the bodyboarding capital of Australia. Which we were back in the day, but like definitely not now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, around the rest of the world, it seems like it's flourishing. Like, you look at the
islands
in Europe and South America, there seems to be a lot of young talent coming through that are ripping and tearing as much as previous generations. Almost a failure in Australia, I would say.
I think it's Australia. And that's what I was kind of alluding to, that it is Australia definitely lacking on that side, yeah, because the world tour is thriving, you know, like there's so many competitors, and the skill is still so there for the next gen and even like the current generation. But yeah, it's just really lacking. I think that we had Louis that was chasing it for a bit, then he fizzled out, and now him not riding for Pride, so he doesn't have that drive to be competitive on the world tour. So there's no real bodyboarder from Australia that's chasing the world tour anymore. There's none.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, there's a couple of West Aussies over there at the moment. Yeah, but there's not like the hordes and the numbers. I know Ryan Hillsmith from Coffs Harbour was competing there for a little bit. Shaden Schrader was obviously competing.
Yeah.
Back in the day, Liam Lucas put the Rashi on for a little bit there, and obviously is, I would say, one of the better younger
drivers
in Australia. Anthony Miller serves pretty good, but yeah, maybe so much. We might have to look at our systems, Dougie. Like, you know, talking about like our bodyboarding clubs and all that.
Back in the day, it used to be the Australian Tour. And if you got in the top 16 of the Aussie Tour, then you got seeded for the pipe comp. So you got seeded to like the third or fourth round of the pipe event. Because I remember I was chasing the Aussie Tour, and I think I got, I can't remember, I think I got like 10th or 11th or something. But yeah, then I went to Hawaii that year and I got seeded to like the third round. So I actually got to paddle out pipe when it was pumping, instead of the scrap. So that is that then was a huge incentive. And also I think sponsorships nowadays don't pay for as much, and the cost of living, all those other financial factors come into it. But I think having the Aussie Tour that people were chasing definitely was a part of, I guess, keeping up with the competition side of it.
Yeah, for sure. It's a shame it's not there anymore, eh? We need
I
some.
know. And like, and some sponsorship contracts actually had it in their contracts that they had to compete in a certain amount of Australian tour events in a year. So I think that as well was a huge factor in getting people, like, because there's still people that are sponsored by like the big companies, but they're just not, there's no clauses to their contract saying, okay, for you to get this amount, you have to attend this and this and that. It's just like, okay, well, you just have to make a clip or you have to attend a team trip. It's not more, it's not about building up the sport and the community within the sport. It's more about like promoting the brands and companies instead.
But I don't think there's like a tour to follow that, like the IBC for sure, but that's all over in Europe and South America. Like it's kind of here. Like how could you put it in their clauses? Because it's
Well,
like.
that's it. Well, that's it. You'd have to, it, like, obviously you couldn't say you have to do an Australian tour, but it might be, have to be like, you have to, I don't know, if you have to submit to the Shark Island challenge trials, or you have, like, I don't know, you got to build the hype back up in competition somehow. And I think, yeah, maybe someone has to take the rein on the Aussie tour and just start off. I think they used to, when they, before they disbanded, it was like, there was only like four events or something. But if you started off, if someone started off like four events, you did like Gold Coast, Cronulla, and like two other places, that you, it's going to be a high entry and like good surf, potentially, like, consistent surf for
Yeah, I think it
competition.
was Benny Obelm was in charge of it, and you had like the Mystics, you had Avalon Pro, you had the D-Bar Pro, and then there was it Knights Wedge in South Australia?
It was. Yeah, so
Yeah.
if you did the four, did that, just build a bit of hype again, and like, and I don't know. That's the only thing I could probably suggest, that
For
like to
sure, you need
build.
grassroots back in Australia, and I think you could look at. I worked for Surf New South Wales on and off for 6 years, and looking at their structure and how their Groms comps feed into their board riders comps, and how you've got so many different tiers that you can work your way up through from like a regional level to a state level to a national level, and then onto the QS and onto the WSL. There's ways to go about it. And I think just again, back to our point about having the trials online, you don't really have the resources currently in bodyboarding because the lack of money from, say, big sponsorship and big companies that want to come on board to kind of get it going again. And it's a bit of a risk for them in certain ways because there is nothing, so to speak, at this stage that they could really secure their financial investment on. Like there's no numbers to go back on it. There's no viewership. There's no like you're getting this many clicks on YouTube or you're getting this many likes or reshares on your reels on Instagram, which it's so sad it's like that, but that's what they're all looking for. So yeah, it's a tough one. I mean I think it will definitely happen again. It's just
Someone's got to take the rein for it. And I think that's what Glenn from Turbo was trying to do, build up like a portfolio, then to pitch it to the bigger companies, and with all the data and stats, to then pitch it to hire companies to make bodyboarding as big as it could be. But we all know how that turned out with Turbo. So,
Yeah, he obviously had great ideas. I just don't think his business ethics were as squeaky clean as they need to be.
no, they're not. And I've actually got an article coming out with his brother,
Really?
which I hit him up about some of those questions. So, yeah, should
Actually, we'll
be.
have to look out for that one.
Yeah.
Sick, man. All right, well, dude, Dougie, thanks again for coming on. Thanks for chewing the fat, and let's talk soon.
Yeah, sounds good, Luke. Have a good
Cheers,
one. Thanks
brother.
again, man.
Happy days, bro. Talk soon.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Sick, bro.